Welcome to Analyst. I'm Pip.
And I'm Freya.
December 2025, low Earth orbit. A satellite the size of a microwave oven called StarCloud 1, with one NVIDIA H100 graphics processing unit on board, runs a large language model. And then, a few weeks later, it does something nobody had done before. It trains a large language model, in orbit, on actual GPUs. Not in a simulator on the ground, in space.
And the company that built it is 2 years old, became a Y Combinator unicorn in March of this year, 2026, at $1.1 billion, and has just filed with the Federal Communications Commission for permission to put up a constellation of 88,000 satellites.
88,000.
88,000. And it is one of four serious efforts right now to put data centres in space. Today we're going to walk through what that actually takes. The physics, the engineering, the law, the money, the players. Because the question, could we host data centres in orbit, and why would we? 5 years ago was a thought experiment. 2 years ago was a feasibility study. As of last winter, it's a thing somebody did.
So the show's job today is, what does it actually take, and why is anyone bothering, and where is this going?
That's the job. Let's start with why anyone is bothering. Because if you don't see the why, the rest of it looks like a stunt. The why begins on the ground, in the place Anna spends most of her professional life, terrestrial data centres, and the constraints that are closing in on them. A modern AI training cluster, the kind that produces a frontier-scale model, draws in the range of hundreds of megawatts. Some of the latest builds are gigawatt scale. For comparison, a single gigawatt is roughly the output of a large nuclear reactor. So a single AI data center campus in 2026 can ask a regional grid for as much power as a nuclear reactor produces, continuously, with very high reliability.
And the grids weren't built for that.
The grids were not built for that. American electrical infrastructure was built to power a slowly growing service economy and a shrinking industrial base. It was emphatically not built for 50 new gigawatts of AI demand to land on its substations in the space of 3 years. The result, in places like Virginia and Texas and Arizona, is a queue. Utilities cannot deliver power to new data center sites on the timelines the operators want. Some of those queues are now measured in years. The PJM Grid Interconnection Queue, that's the region covering most of the Mid-Atlantic and stretching into the Midwest, is now a 5+ year wait for new generation. And the queue is itself larger than the existing installed capacity of the grid. Texas, on ERCOT, similar story. Northern Virginia, what's called Data Center Alley, Loudoun and Prince William counties, the largest concentration of data centers in the world, Dominion Energy has told customers they may not be able to deliver requested power until the early 2030s. The infrastructure project to deliver it doesn't exist yet. Some Virginia counties have started talking openly about moratoria on new data center construction. Aurora, Colorado has done it. The constraint is no longer hypothetical. The hyperscale operators feel it monthly. And then there's water. Modern data centers use enormous amounts of water for cooling, evaporative cooling towers in particular. A single hyperscale facility can use hundreds of millions of gallons a year. In places like Phoenix or Mecklenburg County, North Carolina, this has become a serious community conflict. The water is real, and the residents notice. And then there's land use, and noise, and the residents themselves. The phrase the industry uses, usually quietly, is host community pushback. It's the polite version of the loud town hall meeting.
So power is constrained, water is constrained, land is constrained, public patience is constrained.
All constrained. And on top of all of that, the demand keeps accelerating. The AI compute build-out is the largest infrastructure boom this industry has ever had, and it's running into limits the industry has never seriously had to think about. Now, there is a long tradition in the history of infrastructure of putting your hardest physical problem in the place where physics solves it for you. Let me give you the analogies, because they matter for understanding why space ever even occurs to anyone. 1858, the first transatlantic telegraph cable. built and laid by a consortium between Britain and the United States. The engineering challenge was unbelievable for its day, laying 2,500 miles of cable across an ocean, 2 miles deep in places. They did it because there was no other way to send a message from London to New York in less than 2 weeks. The infrastructure went where the physics required. Iceland data centers. Today, Iceland hosts a significant fraction of the world's energy-intensive computing. Bitcoin mining first, hyperscale facilities increasingly. Why? 2 reasons. 1, the country runs on geothermal and hydroelectric power, so electricity is both cheap and clean. 2, and this is the part most people miss, Iceland's air is cold year-round. You can cool a data center with outside air pulled straight in through filters. No cooling towers, no water. The physics of the place does the cooling for you.
Norway and Sweden, same logic, with fjord water as a heatsink.
The Pacific Northwest, same logic with hydropower.
The pattern is, when terrestrial constraints get tight enough, the industry goes looking for the place where the physics is favourable.
Putting infrastructure in space is the next entry on that list. The question is whether the math closes.
And the people now claiming the math closes, what's their specific argument?
3 things. 1. Solar power above the atmosphere is enormous. You get about 30% more sunlight per square meter than you do on the best terrestrial solar site, because you don't have an atmosphere absorbing it. And in the right orbit, a sun-synchronous polar orbit, for example, you never enter the Earth's shadow. The sun never sets on your satellite. You have unlimited power, free, 24 hours a day.
2. Cooling.
And I want to be careful here, because this one is more complicated than the proponents usually admit. But the core point is real. You are radiating heat into a sink at approximately 2.7 Kelvin, the temperature of the cosmic microwave background. The temperature differential between a warm computer and deep space is enormous. The thermodynamics are favourable.
3. You are not building on anyone's land. Nobody has a town hall about the orbital slot at 22,000 kilometres above the equator. There's no water table to drain. There's no neighbour.
That's the pitch.
That's the pitch. And there is a serious version of it, and a hand-wavy version of it. Most of what you read in the trade press is the hand-wavy version. In the next part of this episode, we go and find the parts that are actually hard. Engineering tour. We're going to walk it in the order it actually matters, which is not the order people usually present it. Power first, because the pitch is correct. Then cooling, because the pitch is incomplete in an important way. Then radiation. Then launch cost. Then repair. Then debris.
Power. The solar constant. The energy from the sun hitting a square meter above the Earth's atmosphere is about 1.36 kilowatts.
On the ground, after the atmosphere takes its cut, and clouds happen and night happens, your effective average is much lower. In a sun-synchronous polar orbit, this is the orbit StarCloud is using, you can be in sunlight essentially continuously, because the orbit's plane is locked to the sun. You get something like 95 to 99% of theoretical maximum, all the time. Modern solar panels at modern efficiencies can produce a kilowatt per square meter of array, give or take. The power side of the equation is genuinely real. If you have area, you have power.
Wait, explain sun synchronous orbit a little, because I think the audience and I both need it. Why does an orbit get to be always in sunlight?
Worth a beat. So, Earth rotates around the sun once a year, and a satellite in low orbit goes around Earth roughly every 90 minutes. A sun-synchronous orbit is engineered so the plane of the orbit precesses around the Earth at exactly 1 degree per day, which is the same rate the Earth moves around the sun. The effect is that the satellite always crosses the equator at the same local solar time every day, year after year. The classic use of this orbit is Earth observation. You take pictures of the same place at the same time of day, so shadows are consistent. The newer use, which is what StarCloud and Project Suncatcher exploit, is that if you choose the right sun-synchronous orbit, what's called a dawn-dusk orbit, riding the terminator between day and night, the satellite essentially never enters Earth's shadow. The sun never sets. Solar panels produce continuously.
So it's an orbit specifically engineered for continuous sunlight.
For free continuous sunlight, with the satellite hanging in perpetual dawn, it's one of the things that makes the orbital solar pitch genuinely strong. Earth has a small advantage in solar intensity per second when the sun is overhead at noon, but loses badly to space when you average over 24 hours, weather, latitude, and seasons. The space version wins on capacity factor by a factor of 3 or 4.
Hold up. Before we go further, plain speech version. How does an orbit even work at all? What's actually happening when something is in orbit?
Good question, because the answer is genuinely beautiful, and almost nobody is taught it correctly in school. Here's the version that actually clicks. An orbit is falling. That's it. A satellite in orbit is falling toward the Earth the whole time. The reason it doesn't hit the ground is that it's also moving sideways, very fast. So it falls toward the Earth, but it's moving sideways so quickly that it falls around the Earth instead of into the Earth. Always falling, always missing. How fast does it have to move sideways to keep missing? Depends on how high you are. Down low, gravity is stronger, so you have to go fast, about 18,000 miles an hour. Up high, gravity is weaker, you can go slower. The moon, 250,000 miles up, only needs to go a couple thousand miles an hour to keep falling around the Earth. And here is the cool part. There is a specific height, about 22,000 miles up, 36,000 kilometers, where the satellite is going around the Earth at exactly the same speed the Earth is rotating, once a day. Which means, from the ground, the satellite looks like it is standing still in the sky. It is not. It is moving thousands of miles an hour. It just looks still because the Earth underneath is keeping up. That is what your TV satellite is doing. Standing still over Brazil, falling around the Earth, going thousands of miles an hour, looking still.
Falling and missing the whole time.
Falling and missing the whole time. That special height, 22,000 miles up, is called geosynchronous orbit, GEO for short, because the satellite is synchronized with the Earth's rotation. For data centers, GEO has the advantage of a constant view of a single ground station. Your dish never has to track a moving target. The disadvantage is, light takes a quarter second to make the round trip to GEO and back. The radiation environment up there is much harsher, and launch costs more because you are going further. Most current orbital data center plans are in low Earth orbit instead. Much closer in, much faster, you trade ground coverage for much better economics.
And why constellations rather than one big satellite?
Two reasons. One, each individual satellite is only line of sight to a given ground station for 10 or 15 minutes per pass. If you want continuous service, you need many satellites passing overhead in sequence. Two, failures. You cannot send a repair tech. So the resilience model is fleet redundancy. Enough units that you can lose some and replace them. The orbital data center looks more like a fleet than a building.
And the size of the arrays for a real data center would be
big. For a 100 megawatt orbital data center, which is a serious facility, comparable to a mid-sized terrestrial one, you're looking at roughly a square kilometer of solar array. That's the kind of structure that has to be assembled in orbit, not launched in one piece. Which is one reason every serious proposal involves orbital assembly or distributed constellations. Power, then, is solvable in principle, hard in execution. Now cooling. And this is the part the press releases don't dwell on. On the ground, when something is hot, you have three ways to move the heat away from it. Conduction. Touch a cold thing to it. Convection. Blow cold air or run cold water past it. And radiation. Emit infrared photons into the surroundings. In a terrestrial data center, the workhorse is convection. Fans push air across the chips, water carries the heat to cooling towers, the towers evaporate the water into the atmosphere. Convection is fast, dense, and effective. In space, you have one of the three: radiation. There is no air. There is no fluid you can dump heat into. The only path the heat can take off your spacecraft is by being emitted as infrared light into the sky.
So cooling in space is radiation only.
Radiation only. And the rate at which a surface radiates heat is governed by a famous law, Stefan Boltzmann, which says the rate scales with the temperature to the fourth power and with the surface area. So your two levers are temperature and area. You can't make the chips hotter, they break. So you need area, a lot of it. For a roughly 100 megawatt data center in orbit, the radiator panels, the surfaces facing away from the sun and away from the Earth, designed to glow infrared into deep space, are estimated, in serious engineering work, to need to be comparable in size to the solar arrays. In some scenarios, larger. Picture this. A structure with a square kilometer of solar panels on one side and a similar or larger area of radiators on the other, dissipating into deep space. That is the shape of a real orbital data center. It is not a satellite. It is a facility, assembled in orbit with one huge dark side and one huge bright side, slowly rotating to keep the geometry correct.
I had not pictured this correctly at all.
Almost nobody pictures it correctly. The thermal problem is the undertold story of orbital computing. It is not vacuum is a great insulator. That's true, and it's the problem, not the solution. It is, you have one way to lose heat, and that way is slow per square meter. So you must have very many square meters. The thermal engineers know this. The marketing decks tend not to dwell.
Pause. Plain speech moment. Walk that back like you're explaining it to a fifth grader, because this is the central thing in the whole episode, and I want it to stick.
Okay, picture a hot mug of coffee on a table. The coffee cools off because heat moves away from it three ways. One, it warms the table underneath. Two, it warms the air around it. The warm air rises, cool air comes in to replace it. Three, it glows. Not visibly, but in infrared. The mug is shining heat into the room as invisible light. On Earth, almost all the cooling is the second way, air carrying the heat off. Now put the mug in space. There is no air. There is nothing touching the mug. The only way the mug can lose heat is the third way, by glowing. And glowing turns out to be slow. A coffee mug glowing into empty space would cool eventually, but it would take a long time, because the surface of the mug is small, and a small surface can't glow off much heat per second. A space data center has the same problem, but enormous. The computers inside make a lot of heat. They can't lose it by touching anything. They can't lose it by warming air, because there is no air. They have to glow it away. And because glowing per square meter is slow, they need a lot of square meters. Huge dark wings sticking out from the data center, glowing invisible heat into the empty sky. That's what the radiators are. Glowing wings in the dark, dumping the heat the computers make.
Okay. The coffee mug landed, the wings landed.
That's the picture to keep. A space data center is a building with two big sides. One bright side, the solar panels catching sunlight, and one dark side, the radiator wings glowing heat back out. The two sides have to be roughly the same size, because energy coming in has to equal energy going out, or the thing cooks itself. Radiation, the next problem. Above the atmosphere, you are bathed in particle radiation, galactic cosmic rays coming in from interstellar space and solar energetic particles when the sun has a tantrum. These particles can do two things to a chip. They can flip a bit, a transient effect called a single event upset, or they can permanently damage the silicon, total ionizing dose, gate rupture, latch up. Standard consumer chips are not designed for any of this.
Hold on. Plain speech version. What does radiation actually do to a chip?
Okay, picture a computer chip. A chip is millions or billions of tiny switches, each one either on or off. That is what computing is, switches flipping in patterns. Space is full of fast particles, tiny pieces of atoms zipping around at huge speeds, sent out by the sun and by exploding stars far away. On Earth, the atmosphere blocks most of them before they reach you. In space, no atmosphere, so they fly right through whatever's there, including chips. When one of those particles hits a chip, three things can happen. One, it flips a switch. A switch that was supposed to be off becomes on, just for a moment. The chip suddenly thinks 2 plus 2 is 5. Usually the software notices the wrong answer, says, wait, that's not right, recomputes, moves on. Annoying, not fatal. 2. It fries apart. The particle dumps so much energy in one spot that the switch actually breaks. That part of the chip stops working forever. If it was a critical part, the whole chip dies. 3. It gives the chip a kind of sunburn. Each particle adds a tiny bit of damage. Over months and years, the damage builds up, and eventually, the chip stops working reliably. That is why satellites have lifespans. Eventually, the radiation eats them.
Flip, fry, sunburn.
Flip, fry, sunburn. Good mnemonic. And the old answer to all of that was special chips. Built for space, much slower than normal chips, very resistant to particles. The new bet, the one StarCloud and Google are making, is that you can use regular consumer chips if you fly lots of them, except that some will die, and replace them when they do.
And those special chips, how far behind the regular ones are they really?
Several generations. Radiation-hardened chips are a real industry, and they are years behind frontier consumer silicon. A radiation-hardened processor flying on a current science mission might be roughly the computational equivalent of a desktop computer from 15 years ago. Which is fine for a Mars rover. It is not fine for AI training. The alternative, and this is the path that everyone now serious about orbital computing is taking, is to fly commercial chips, with shielding, with redundancy, and with the willingness to lose some of them. SpaceX has demonstrated this at scale with Starlink, which uses standard commercial silicon on tens of thousands of satellites. Google, very interestingly, tested its Trillium generation TPUs in a particle accelerator simulating the radiation environment of low Earth orbit, and the chips came through. That test result, published with the Project Suncatcher announcement in late 2025, is part of why the project moved from "we should do this" to "we have permission to try."
So radiation, the engineering field that used to say you can't fly consumer chips, is now saying, actually, maybe you can.
Is now saying, actually, with care, you can. It's a significant shift, and it is one of the reasons this whole topic is alive right now. Launch cost. The third hard problem, and the one that determines whether any of this scales beyond niche. As of 2026, SpaceX's Falcon 9, the most economical operational rocket, gets you to low Earth orbit for about $2,700 per kilogram. That is, by historical standards, miraculously cheap. Call it a factor of 10 lower than the space shuttle era. And it is still too expensive for orbital data centers at scale. Starship. SpaceX's next vehicle, much larger, designed for full reusability, is the bet that changes the math. The current experimental flights, not yet fully reusable, are putting cost in the $800 to $1,000 per kilogram range. The design target, with full reusability, is below $100 per kilogram. Elon Musk's stated long-term aim is $10 per kilogram. Most outside analysts call the $100 number plausible if the rocket works as designed, and call the $10 number aspirational. The European Commission's Ascend feasibility study, which is the most rigorous public look at the economics of space data centers conducted by a consortium led by Thales Alenia Space, results published June 27, 2024, set the economic break-even for orbital data centers at, roughly, the cost of a Starship-class reusable launcher. If Starship works as advertised, the math closes. If it doesn't, it doesn't. The entire orbital data center industry is, in effect, a leveraged bet on the Starship development program.
That is a remarkable position to be building a market on.
It is, and the players know it. Most of them are sequencing, starting with small payloads that the economics already justify, and scaling as launch costs come down. Nobody is going to put their 100 megawatt facility up first and hope. Two more, repair and debris. Repair, you mostly don't. There is no plumber in orbit. There was for Hubble. 5 space shuttle missions over 15 years, fixing and upgrading the telescope. Each one a multi-billion dollar exercise. That model is not viable for a commercial data center. The realistic model is design for redundancy, accept individual failures, and replace whole modules when they fail enough. This is why Google's Project Suncatcher is shaped the way it is. 81 satellites in a tight formation, separated by hundreds of meters, free space optical links between them carrying terabits per second. If one satellite dies, you launch a replacement. You do not fix the dead one. The whole architecture assumes a population of computing units, not a fixed installation. Debris, the last hard problem, and it is becoming a hard problem. Low Earth orbit is getting crowded. Starlink alone is around 6,000 satellites and rising. China's planned constellations add many thousands more. Add 88,000 from StarCloud's filing. Yes, 88,000. And you are talking about a sky that is, by 2030, an order of magnitude busier than it is today. Each satellite is a potential collision risk for every other satellite. Pieces of broken satellites are a risk for everything. There is a hypothetical worst case called Kessler syndrome, a chain reaction of collisions producing more debris, producing more collisions, eventually rendering certain orbital regimes unusable for decades.
Has anyone responsible been raising this loudly?
Yes. And one of the loudest critiques of Project Suncatcher specifically, published shortly after the announcement, was on this point. Google's response, in a follow-up white paper in January 2026, was to detail the active collision avoidance systems planned for the constellation: autonomous maneuvering, predictive trajectory modeling, fragment tracking. It is a real, hard, currently unsolved coordination problem at the level of the global space environment. Whether the industry self-regulates, or governments impose limits, or the first major Kessler-adjacent event forces a reckoning, that's open.
So the engineering picture is power, solvable. Cooling, solvable, but with very large radiators nobody mentions. Radiation, just barely manageable with current commercial silicon, recently demonstrated. Launch cost, a leveraged bet on Starship. Repair, you don't, you replace. Debris, a real and growing problem still being worked.
That's the picture. Engineering does not stop this from happening. Engineering tells you the shape of what gets built. Distributed constellations of small units with enormous radiator and solar surface area in carefully chosen orbits designed for fleet replacement rather than maintenance.
One more question before we leave the engineering. Why now? Like, why is this happening in 2026 and not in 1995? Most of the physics has been understood for decades.
Good question. Because the answer is the whole story underneath this episode. Five things had to happen simultaneously, and all five did in the last decade. Going to walk them. 1. Reusable launch. The cost per kilogram to orbit collapse that SpaceX delivered with Falcon 9, with Starship continuing the curve. In 1995, Space Shuttle was the workhorse, about $54,000 per kilogram in today's dollars. Today, Falcon 9 is around $2,700, a factor of 20 in 3 decades. None of this is even arguable on Earth without that. 2. Commercial silicon survival in space. Starlink, since 2019, has flown commercial-grade chips on tens of thousands of satellites with operationally viable failure rates. That is 30 years of "you can't fly consumer parts in space" turning out to be wrong, demonstrated at industrial scale. Project Suncatcher's TPU survival in the radiation chamber test was the latest data point in that curve. Not the first. 3. The AI demand pulse. There was no business case for orbital compute in 1995 because terrestrial compute was abundant and cheap. The AI training boom of the early 2020s created, for the first time, a customer, someone who would pay for compute even at non-trivial cost premiums because terrestrial bottlenecks were binding. NVIDIA's existence as the dominant chip supplier with a customer base that is grid-capped is the demand side of the equation. 4. Solar panel mass efficiency. The watts per kilogram of modern solar panels is dramatically higher than 1990s technology. Modern thin film and high efficiency silicon panels deliver several times more power per unit launch mass. That changes the launch math, separately from the launch cost trend. 5. Small satellite mass production. The CubeSat revolution, plus advanced manufacturing techniques, including additive manufacturing for spacecraft structures, has driven satellite costs down by another factor of 10 over the same period. The thing you'd have hand-built for tens of millions in 1995, you can now mass-produce on an assembly line for a few hundred thousand.
Five trends converging. Each one alone wouldn't have done it. Together, the math closes.
Together, the math closes. That's why this is a 2026 story. None of it is a new physics result. All of it is the engineering and economics finally catching up with what was always possible.
Part 3. The lawyers and the diplomats.
The legal regime governing space is older than the Apollo program. The foundational document is the Outer Space Treaty, signed in 1967. Ratified now by more than 110 countries, including every major spacefaring nation. Three principles from it matter for our purposes. 1. Outer space is not subject to national appropriation. No country can claim sovereignty over an orbit, or a piece of the moon, or an asteroid. The treaty's authors were trying to keep the Cold War from extending into a new domain. It worked. 2. States are responsible for the activities of their nationals in space. If a private American company puts a data center in orbit, the United States, as the launching state, bears international legal responsibility for what that data center does. It is not a libertarian frontier. 3. There is a liability convention from 1972 that makes the launching state strictly liable for damage caused by its space objects on the surface of the Earth, and liable based on fault for damage in space. If your data center collides with someone else's satellite, somebody's lawyers are working through that very treaty.
So sovereign responsibility, even for private operators. Good. What about data?
That is the genuinely novel problem, and it is largely unsettled. We have built our entire framework for data law, privacy law, sovereignty law, lawful access, on the assumption that data sits on a server, and the server sits in a country, and that country's law applies. The European Union's GDPR is about data in or about Europe. The US Cloud Act extends American legal process to data held by American companies anywhere in the world. China's data sovereignty laws assume Chinese servers in Chinese territory.
A data center in orbit breaks all of these assumptions at once. The server is not in any country. The launching state is responsible for the object. But is the data in that state? Is it in the country of the operator? Is it in the country where the data subject lives? Is it in the country where the user querying the data lives? There is, as of 2026, no settled answer.
So you could put data in orbit specifically to escape a given jurisdiction?
You could try. And, interestingly, you could also do the opposite. You could put data in orbit specifically to enforce sovereignty. The European Ascend Consortium's pitch was, in part, that European data sovereignty could be guaranteed by holding the data on European-owned spacecraft, beyond reach of American or Chinese legal process. The data sovereignty paradox is real. The same architecture can be used either way, depending on whose flag is on the satellite. There is also the export control problem. Many of the most advanced chips, the H100 GPUs that StarCloud is flying, the TPUs Google is flying, are subject to US export controls under what's called ITAR, the International Traffic in Arms Regulations, and under the Commerce Department's chip export rules that have tightened significantly since 2022. Putting export-controlled silicon on a satellite that operates in international space and serves customers possibly in restricted countries, the lawyers have not finished writing the rules. They are being written now, in licensing decisions made one filing at a time. And then there is the geopolitical layer. Critical commercial infrastructure that sits in orbit is, by definition, vulnerable to anti-satellite weapons. Russia, China, the United States, and India have all demonstrated anti-satellite capability. The unspoken question is, if your bank's data, or your country's tax records, or your hospital system's electronic health records sit in an orbital data center, what is the deterrent posture against the possibility that someone might shoot it down? This is not a hypothetical that defense planners have not considered. It is exactly the kind of strategic vulnerability that the militaries of the major powers are paid to think about.
So critical infrastructure in space is great until somebody else realises it's critical and reachable.
Until somebody else realises it's critical and reachable. There are international agreements against the testing of anti-satellite weapons that produce orbital debris. The United States, for example, has committed to a moratorium. But there is no comprehensive ban on anti-satellite weapons themselves. The legal regime governing what you can do to a satellite in wartime, or in pre-wartime grey zone conflict, is even less mature than the regime governing what you can do with one.
And the kinetic attacks aren't the only kind. The contemporary case study.
The contemporary case study is Viasat. February 24, 2022, the morning of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Russian state-sponsored actors executed a cyber attack against Viasat's KASAT satellite network. The attack targeted the ground modems rather than the satellites themselves, pushing destructive firmware updates that bricked tens of thousands of modems across Europe in the opening hours of the war. The Ukrainian military lost a significant chunk of its satellite communications minutes before the invasion began. Spillover effects took down 5,500 German wind turbines that used the same network for remote management. The attack is widely considered the most consequential cyber operation of the war.
And the takeaway for orbital data centres is?
The takeaway is that you do not have to shoot the satellite to take it offline. You can attack the ground segment, the uplinks, the operators' networks, the supply chain that builds the satellites in the first place. The kinetic ASAT story gets the headlines, but the contemporary record says non-kinetic attacks on space-adjacent infrastructure are far more common, far cheaper, and already happening. Any orbital data center is going to be at least as much a cybersecurity problem as a physics problem. And the historical debris precedent worth knowing. January 2007, China conducted a kinetic anti-satellite test, destroying its own defunct weather satellite, the FY-1C, at about 800 kilometers altitude. The destruction created roughly 3,000 pieces of trackable debris, and many more pieces too small to track. Those fragments are still in orbit. They will remain in orbit for decades to centuries. It is, by a wide margin, the single worst debris-generating event in the history of human spaceflight. It is the reason that, when somebody proposes putting 88,000 satellites in orbit, the responsible reaction is not just, wow, but also, and what's the plan for when one of them gets hit? One more legal piece worth naming, because of the lunar angle. Lone Star, one of the four players we'll talk about in the last part, is specifically pursuing data centers on the moon, with a disaster recovery use case. The moon is governed by the Outer Space Treaty, plus, theoretically, the Moon Treaty of 1979, which barely any spacefaring nation has ratified, plus, in practice, the Artemis Accords of 2020, which are a US-led framework that creates safety zones around lunar operations. China and Russia have not signed. The lunar legal regime is, candidly, the least settled jurisdictional environment available for hosting your customers' data. Whether that's a feature or a bug depends on the customer.
And there's a parallel framework, right? Not just Artemis.
There's a parallel framework, and it's worth naming because this is the shape of lunar geopolitics for the next decade. The American-led framework is the Artemis Accords. As of 2026, signed by something like 50-plus countries, including most of NATO, plus Japan, India, the UAE, Brazil, others. Built around interoperability, resource utilization, and the safety zone concept that lets one operator request a buffer around its activities. The parallel framework is the China-Russia International Lunar Research Station, ILRS, a separate program with separate partners, including a number of countries in the Belt and Road sphere. Different rules, different operating principles, different long-term vision. If you are operating a commercial lunar data center, you are operating in a regime where two competing legal frameworks coexist, and neither one fully claims the body. The closest historical analogue is probably Antarctica during the early Cold War. Multiple national programs operating in the same place under a treaty regime that nobody fully agrees on the meaning of. Antarctica got the Antarctic Treaty in 1959 that mostly worked. The moon may or may not get its equivalent before the commercial activity gets ahead of the law. As of right now, the activity is ahead.
Part 4. The people building it now.
Before we walk the four big efforts going after the future market, the AI training market, the sovereign storage market, the eventual general orbital compute market, there's something to say first. Because orbital computing isn't new in 2026. There is an orbital compute market that's been live for years, and we should walk it, because it's the foundation under everything else.
The already existing orbital compute market.
Already existing orbital compute market. The use case is Earth observation. Satellites that take pictures of Earth for agricultural monitoring, ship tracking, fire detection, defense intelligence, climate monitoring. There are thousands of them. And those satellites have a specific structural problem that orbital computing solves elegantly.
The problem is bandwidth. A modern Earth observation satellite with high-resolution sensors generates enormously more raw data than it can downlink to a ground station per pass. A typical small Earth observation satellite might generate terabits of imagery per day and have a downlink budget of maybe a few hundred gigabits. The ratio is off by a factor of 10 or more. If you try to downlink everything, you can't. You have to choose.
So the satellite collects 100 gigabytes of imagery and can only send back 10 gigabytes.
Right. And the historical answer to that was, you downlinked the raw data on a strict schedule, you tiled and compressed it, you accepted long latencies between observation and actionable intelligence, several days, sometimes.
The new answer is, you put a small AI processor on board the satellite. You run a model that examines the imagery in real time and looks for what the customer actually wants. Ships in a specific harbour, new construction at a specific facility, wildfires across the western United States. Then you downlink only the findings. I see a ship of class X at location Y. Here's the cropped image. Not the raw pixel fire hose. The bandwidth requirement collapses, and the latency from observation to actionable intelligence drops from days to minutes. Companies actually doing this today at commercial scale. Spire Global, which runs a constellation of nanosatellites for weather and maritime data with onboard AI. BlackSky on the imaging intelligence side. Loft Orbital, which provides shared satellite infrastructure that other companies can run their compute payloads on. There are others. The market is real, it has paying customers, and the customers are largely governments and defense. Because the use cases, maritime domain awareness, infrastructure monitoring, change detection, those are intelligence problems.
So your professional world specifically, that's the live market.
That's the live market. The intelligence community is already a paying customer for orbital compute. The next steps, bigger compute, bigger workloads, eventually general purpose data centers, those are the future. And that's what the four big efforts we're about to walk are pursuing. But the platform on which they're building is not greenfield. The platform is, orbital compute has been doing useful, real work for a decade in a narrow but lucrative niche. With that as the ground truth, here are the four big bets on what broader orbital compute looks like. Four serious efforts, each pursuing a different theory of the business. Walked in order from scrappiest to most established. First, StarCloud, American startup, until 2024 called Lumen Orbit. Founded by a young team, including Philip Johnston, with the explicit pitch of putting AI compute in orbit. Backed, importantly, by NVIDIA, the maker of the H100 GPU that became the workhorse of the AI training boom. NVIDIA's backing is two things at once. It is money, and it is access to chips that are otherwise allocation constrained globally.
Pause on Philip Johnston, because his background is interesting.
It is. Johnston is not from the space industry. His early career was political. He was a speechwriter for Tony Blair, the former UK Prime Minister, before pivoting into technology. Reportedly, came to the orbital compute idea while at the Y Combinator program, after looking at the economics of terrestrial data center expansion, and concluding that the constraints we walked in part one were not going to resolve themselves on the timeline AI needed. The company was originally called Lumen Orbit. It became StarCloud after the Series A. The Tony Blair speechwriter to orbital data center founder trajectory is not the kind of career that appears in space industry biographies often. And it is in some ways characteristic of the moment. The people building this are coming from outside the legacy aerospace world.
And NVIDIA's logic for backing them. Spell that out, because it's not obvious.
It's not obvious, and it's important.
NVIDIA in 2026 is selling something like $100 billion a year of AI chips. The dominant constraint on its growth is not, anymore, manufacturing capacity. TSMC has caught up. The dominant constraint on NVIDIA's growth is its customers' ability to actually deploy the chips they buy. And customers can't deploy them if there's no power available to run them. The grid bottleneck on NVIDIA's customers is, indirectly, a bottleneck on NVIDIA's growth. If you can sell GPUs into orbital data centers powered by free solar, you remove the grid constraint from the equation. NVIDIA is investing in StarCloud, and similar bets, because the chipmaker's long-term revenue depends on its customers having power, and Orbit is the unconstrained power play. The NVIDIA investment is not about StarCloud the company. It is about NVIDIA's own growth path. StarCloud became, in March 2026, the fastest unicorn in Y Combinator's history, reaching a $1.1 billion valuation 17 months after completing the program. November 2025, they launched StarCloud 1, a small satellite with one H100 GPU, into low Earth orbit. December 2025, that satellite became the first to run a large language model in space, and the first to train one in orbit on a GPU. StarCloud 2 is planned for full operation in sun-synchronous orbit in 2026. And in February 2026, the company filed with the US Federal Communications Commission for spectrum authorization for a constellation of up to 88,000 satellites for orbital data centers.
88,000. Putting it in scale, Starlink, the biggest constellation currently flying, is around 6,000 and growing toward maybe 12,000 at full deployment. StarCloud is filing for an order of magnitude more.
An order of magnitude more. The filing itself is partly aspirational and partly tactical. You ask for what you might possibly want, the regulatory process trims it down. But the ambition is clear. The StarCloud thesis is, orbital AI compute will be a large enough business that you need, eventually, very many small distributed satellites doing the work.
Second, Lone Star Data Holdings. Florida-based. Founded by Chris Stott, a long-time space industry person. Their theory of the business is different from StarCloud's. They are not chasing AI training. They are chasing data storage. Specifically, sovereign and resilient data storage. In January 2026, they launched their first two data center nodes into low Earth orbit. Their first commercial product, called StarVault, launches in October 2026. Their longer-term play is data centers on the moon, explicitly framed as disaster recovery and as data sovereign of any single nation's legal reach.
Chris Stott's background, different generation, different path?
Different path entirely. Stott has been in the space industry for 30 plus years. He was deeply involved in setting up the Isle of Man as a small state space jurisdiction. Yes, that Isle of Man. The tax-favourable small island in the Irish Sea. Through a company called Mansat. The Isle of Man, partly through his work, became a recognised national administration for satellite filings, with a sovereign satellite registry, advantageous tax treatment, and a quiet but real role in the commercial space industry. So Stott's whole career has been at the intersection of space and sovereign jurisdiction, figuring out how to do space activity in legally clever places. Lone Star's pitch, your data, beyond any nation's legal reach, is a direct extension of work he's been doing for two decades. He's the person who would build this, because he has the legal architecture instincts the technical engineers don't, and the space industry connections to actually fly the missions.
So Lone Star is selling the ultimate off-site backup.
The ultimate off-site backup, with a sovereignty story attached. And worth being precise about what Lone Star is actually doing in 2026, versus what they're planning. The January 2026 launches put two data nodes into low Earth orbit, small payloads riding along on a SpaceX rideshare mission. Those nodes are demonstration units, real but limited. StarVault, the October 2026 product, is the first commercial storage offering. Capacity reservations being taken now, customers including a couple of named financial institutions that have made it known they're piloting.
The lunar piece is more nuanced than the press coverage suggests. Lone Star is not, in any near-term mission, building data centers on the surface of the moon. They are flying data payloads on lunar lander missions provided by other companies. The company that landed Lone Star's earlier demonstration payload was Intuitive Machines, on a lunar surface mission funded partly by NASA's Commercial Lunar Payload Services Program, CLPS. So the picture is, Lone Star's hardware rides along on commercial and quasi-commercial lunar landers, sits on the surface, stores data, talks to Earth via the lander's communications. They are leveraging the broader lunar infrastructure other people are building, rather than building lunar infrastructure themselves. That's a reasonable business strategy. It also means the timeline is bounded by what the lunar landing industry can actually deliver, which is, at the moment, somewhat halting. The Intuitive Machines mission that carried Lone Star's payload partially failed. The lander tipped over on landing. The data survived. The lander did not.
The orbital and lunar markets are interconnected in a way the press releases don't always make clear.
They are entirely interconnected. Lone Star's success depends on the lunar landing industry maturing, which is a separate set of companies with their own risk profile. The pitch is niche product, real demand from particular industries, financial institutions, governments of small states, organizations worried about both physical and legal compromise. The execution risk is partially their own and partially the broader lunar economies. Third, Google's Project Suncatcher. The newest of the four, announced November 4, 2025, Google is partnering with Planet Labs, a satellite imaging company. The plan is, initially, two satellites by early 2027, each equipped with Google's own Trillium Generation Tensor Processing Units, or TPUs. The longer plan is an 81-satellite cluster flying in a tight 1 kilometer radius formation, satellites separated by as little as a few hundred meters, communicating via free space optical links carrying tens of terabits per second between them.
A few hundred meters apart, flying at orbital velocity. That's 17,000 miles per hour, dodging each other.
17,000 miles per hour, dodging each other and the debris environment, using autonomous flight control. That part is genuinely new and hard. The chip side, Google publicly disclosed that their Trillium TPUs were tested in a particle accelerator simulating low Earth orbit radiation and survived without damage. That test was the gate that let the project go from internal research to public announcement. Google's theory of the business is the most ambitious of the four. They are not selling capacity to anyone. They are building it for themselves, because the demand growth on their own AI compute is outrunning their ability to source terrestrial power. And because Google has decided, at the company level, that this is the moonshot worth taking. Hence the name, Project Suncatcher. The light is the resource. You go where the light is.
Two pieces of this that are worth slowing down on. One, the Trillium TPUs versus the NVIDIA chip StarCloud uses. Why does Google's choice matter?
It matters because it's the first orbital data center bet built around chips the operator owns end to end. NVIDIA chips are sold to all comers and operationally constrained by NVIDIA's allocation decisions. Google's TPUs, Tensor Processing Units, Google's own AI chip line, currently in their Trillium generation, with V6E being the unit going to orbit, are designed in-house, fabricated through a foundry partnership, and used exclusively in Google's own systems. So Suncatcher gives Google compute capacity that is Google all the way down. Google chips, Google software, Google network. That is structurally different from buying GPUs from a chip company. It is the cloud provider version of the bet.
And two, the Planet Labs partnership. Why Planet specifically?
Planet Labs is one of the most established commercial satellite operators. They run a large fleet of Earth observation satellites, DOVES,
that they manufacture, launch, and operate themselves. They have something Google does not. Deep operational experience flying satellite constellations. Building one satellite is hard. Operating a constellation, managing the orbital traffic, the conjunctions, the maneuvers, the failures, the replacements, the ground network coordination, is a different and harder problem. And it's a problem you mostly learn by doing. Google could, in principle, build the spacecraft side themselves. Partnering with Planet skips a decade of learning curve. Planet, in turn, gets a customer for a new product line and visibility into where the orbital infrastructure economy is going. The partnership is mutually load-bearing.
The other technical piece worth naming is the inter-satellite optical links. Free space optical communications. Lasers between satellites. Not radio. The advantages? Bandwidth measured in tens of terabits per second, comparable to fiber optic cables on Earth. No spectrum licensing required, because lasers are tightly directional. No interference with terrestrial radio users. The challenge? Pointing accuracy. To shoot a laser from one satellite to another, a few hundred meters away, both moving at 17,000 miles an hour, and changing relative positions every second, requires pointing precision measured in microradians, and tracking systems updating thousands of times per second. The technology has been demonstrated. Starlink uses it now between its second-generation satellites. NASA has flown demonstrations called T-Bird. Commercial systems are starting to ship. Some catches 81 satellite cluster, with inter-satellite optical links carrying tens of terabits per second, becomes, in effect, a single distributed computer. The satellites are nodes, the optical links are the bus, and the cluster functions as one large machine, even though no single component is itself large.
That's a different mental picture than satellites in a constellation. That's a computer the size of a kilometer.
A computer the size of a kilometer. That's the right mental picture. And the trick that makes it work is the optical links. Fourth, the European Commission's Ascend Consortium, led by Thales Alenia Space, with partners across Europe, Airbus Defence and Space, the German Aerospace Agency DLR, Hewlett-Packard Enterprise on the cloud computing side, Ariane Group on the launcher side, Carbone 4 and Vito on the environmental side. Ascend stands for Advanced Space Cloud for European Net Zero Emission and Data Sovereignty. The pitch is explicitly European. Sovereign data hosted on European infrastructure beyond American or Chinese legal reach. Powered by clean orbital solar, in service of the European Green Deal's net zero by 2050 goal. The feasibility study's results, published June 27, 2024, validated the concept, including the in-orbit assembly architecture, contingent on Starship-class launch economics.
So those are the four: StarCloud, Scrappy, AI First, backed by NVIDIA, Lone Star, Sovereign Storage, Florida, with lunar ambitions, Project Suncatcher, Google's internal moonshot, Ascend, European sovereignty and sustainability. Different theories, different geographies, different time horizons.
Different theories, different geographies, different time horizons. And, this is the part that surprises people, they are not really competing with each other yet. The market they're collectively building does not exist. They are each making a different bet on what the first viable market looks like.
And the other players? Because four is not really four. What else is in the field?
Real point. The other names worth knowing? Japan. There is a serious Japanese effort that gets less coverage in English language press than the American ones. The principal players are NTT, Nippon Telegraph and Telephone, one of the largest telecommunications companies in the world, and Sky Perfect JSAT, the largest Japanese satellite operator. The two of them have a joint program to build what they call a space-integrated computing network, orbital data centers, optical inter-satellite links, integration with terrestrial 6G mobile networks. The Japanese pitch is different from the American or European pitches. It emphasizes integration with the existing telecommunications grid, with the data centers as nodes in a hybrid terrestrial orbital network. It's less about replacing the data center, more about extending the network into orbit. The first demonstration missions are planned for the late 2020s.
Axiom Space, an American company building what is intended to become the first commercial space station. Initially attached to the International Space Station, eventually free-flying after the ISS retires. Axiom's pitch isn't just a data center, but compute is part of the planned commercial offering. The model is a private space station with the ability to host commercial payloads, including AI compute, microgravity research, in-space manufacturing. A different shape than the satellite constellation model, more like an orbital industrial park.
Vast Space, another private station company with similar but more aggressive timelines, planning to launch their first station in the late 2020s. And then there is the Chinese ecosystem. Less public, less easily characterized from open sources, but real.
China's national space program has its own AI computing ambitions in orbit. And the major Chinese tech companies, Alibaba, Tencent, have made statements about interest in space-based infrastructure. The Tiangong Space Station, China's permanent crewed station, already hosts some compute payloads. Multiple Chinese commercial satellite operators are in the field. The Chinese effort is genuinely large. It is also genuinely opaque to outside analysts in a way the American and European efforts are not. We should not make strong claims about scale or timeline, because the public information does not support them. We should note the program exists and is non-trivial.
So the global picture is American startups, big tech moonshots, European sovereignty consortia, Japanese telco integration, Chinese state-backed parallel programs, multiple national approaches running in parallel.
Multiple national approaches, multiple business models, very limited overlap of approach. That tells you something about where we are in the development curve. When the same problem is being attacked by multiple, structurally different approaches, the problem is in its early phase. The shakeout, where the field consolidates around one or two models, hasn't happened yet. It may take 5 to 10 years.
One more customer worth naming, the military.
The military, worth its own beat.
Because among all the potential customers for orbital data centers, the most predictable early adopter is, already is, the United States Space Force and its peers in other militaries. Space Force was stood up in 2019 as the sixth branch of the US Armed Services. Its remit includes both protecting US assets in space and operationalizing space capability for the rest of the military. A specific Space Force office, the Space Systems Command, is in the business of buying capability, including, increasingly, compute capability from commercial providers. The model is sometimes called commercial first, or buy, don't build, and it shifts a lot of the procurement weight onto private operators like SpaceX, Planet, BlackSky, and the orbital data center companies we just walked. The use cases for orbital compute in defense are concrete. Tactical intelligence processing, taking satellite imagery, running ML models on it on board, downlinking results to the warfighter in near real time. The same Earth observation edge processing pattern we walked at the top of this part, but for military targets. Resilient command and control, backing up critical military software and data in orbit, beyond the reach of terrestrial sabotage, cyber attack, or kinetic attack. Communications routing, moving traffic through space-based nodes when terrestrial networks are compromised or denied.
There is a classification piece that's currently being figured out. Most defense compute today happens in dedicated, certified, on-the-ground facilities, SCIFs, Sensitive Compartmented Information Facilities, with strict physical and electronic isolation. Orbital data centers would extend that classification environment into space, which raises real questions about whether the technical architectures of a star cloud or a suncatcher are compatible with the security requirements of, say, the Joint Worldwide Intelligence Communication System. The answer is being written one accreditation decision at a time. The defense contractors who specialize in cleared compute environments, Lockheed, Raytheon, Northrop, Boeing, are involved.
So the customer that's most likely to actually pay the early bills in size is the US government.
Most likely to actually pay the early bills in size is the US government, plus allied militaries.
The commercial customer base, the AI labs needing training compute, the financial institutions needing sovereign storage, is real and growing, But the government check is usually the one that lets you build the second satellite. That has been true of the entire commercial space industry since SpaceX took its first NASA contract in 2008. There is no reason to think orbital data centers will be different.
My honest read, drawing on all the public material, on what comes first and what comes later. First, and this is the next 2 to 4 years, orbital storage for sovereign and disaster recovery use cases. Lone Star's product. Very high latency to retrieve. Very high sovereignty. Very strong resilience against terrestrial catastrophe. Niche, but real customers. Second, and this is roughly the same window, orbital training for AI workloads where latency doesn't matter, the cost of terrestrial power has become the binding constraint, and the operator owns its own chips. StarCloud's product and Google's eventual product. Training a model is a batch job. You can tolerate hours of round-trip time. Inference, where users expect milliseconds, stays on Earth. The two-tier architecture, training in space, inference on the ground, is the likely shape.
Walk that two-tier pace a little deeper, because it's the economic logic that holds everything else together. And do the plain speech version first, because training and inference are words AI people throw around like everyone knows what they mean, and I don't think we actually do.
Fair. Plain speech first, then the technical version. Imagine you are teaching a kid to recognise dog breeds. You sit down with the kid and 10,000 pictures of dogs, each one labelled. Corgi, Poodle, Beagle, St. Bernard. You go through the stack with the kid over and over. After a while, the kids start seeing patterns. Fluffy tail, short legs, that's a corgi. The teaching takes a long time, maybe months. But once the kid has learned it, the learning is done. Then later, someone walks up to the kid with a new picture and says, "What breed is this?" The kid looks, thinks for a second, says, "Corgi." Fast. 1 second. Already knows how. Those are the two operations. Training is the long, slow, expensive teaching part. Inference is the fast, quick, answer a question part. Training only happens once per model. You teach the model once, you are done with the teaching. Inference happens millions of times, every time anyone asks the model a question. When you use ChatGPT, you are doing inference. Someone else, before you ever showed up, did the training. Months of computer time, huge amounts of electricity, before the chatbot existed at all. They taught the chatbot. You are asking it questions.
And the orbital data center bet? Oh.
The orbital data center bet is, the teaching part is slow, electricity hungry, and you can do it on a delay. It does not matter if it finishes Tuesday afternoon or Wednesday morning. Move the teaching to space, where electricity is free. Then ship the trained model down to Earth, where it answers your questions in a second.
Teach in space, answer on Earth.
Teach in space, answer on Earth. That's the two-tier architecture in plain words.
Okay, now the technical version for the people who want it.
It's worth slowing on. Training and inference have completely different economic profiles. Training a large model is a one-time job. Call it weeks of compute, then it's done. The model trains. You copy the resulting weights down once. You serve queries against those weights from then on. Latency during training is irrelevant. Nobody cares if your gradient updates take an extra 100 milliseconds. What you care about during training is cost per flop, cost per floating point operation, multiplied by the trillions of operations a training run requires. That cost is dominated by the cost of electricity, the cost of cooling, the cost of the data center building. Move those costs into orbit, where the electricity is free and the cooling is the cosmic microwave background, and the economics tilt toward orbit even with the launch cost premium, assuming the launch costs are in the Starship range. Inference is the opposite. Inference is a user-facing operation. A user asks ChatGPT a question, they expect an answer in a second or two. They are sitting on Earth. If the inference happens in orbit, the round-trip light-speed latency alone adds tens to hundreds of milliseconds depending on orbit and ground station geometry. Plus queuing, plus network, plus the actual computation. The latency budget is too tight. Inference stays on Earth, close to the user.
So the architecture is, you train your model on satellites in orbit, where electricity is free, and you periodically push the trained model weights down to terrestrial data centers, where users actually query it. Two separate tiers, each optimized for its own constraint. And this architecture only works for AI workloads with that specific structure. Heavy training, lightweight inference. It does not work for, say, transactional databases, where every read has to be responsive in milliseconds. It does not work for video streaming. It works specifically for AI model development and for some other batch processing workloads. Which is fine, because AI model development is the workload that's straining the terrestrial grid in the first place. The architecture matches the problem. Third, 5 to 10 years out, contingent on Starship, general orbital compute capacity at competitive prices, sold by the hour. This is the version where space data centers are an option an AWS or an Azure customer can select from a menu. It depends on launch costs continuing to fall, on the radiation engineering continuing to mature, on the debris problem being managed at the industry level, and on the legal framework getting written. None of those are blockers. All of them are conditions. Fourth, and this is the speculative far end, the industrial vision. Jeff Bezos has talked repeatedly about moving all heavy industry off Earth, using Blue Origin as the launch infrastructure for that vision. Gerard K. O'Neill, in a 1976 book called The High Frontier, sketched the original version of this. Orbital colonies, industrial activity, large-scale solar power, all in space, leaving Earth as the residential zone. The data center version of that vision is the 88,000 satellite version. Whether any of that actually happens depends on physics, on economics, and on whether anyone makes the political case strongly enough to do it.
One more pattern worth naming before we close, because it's the analogue that I think actually matches this story best. Satellite TV.
Yes, the analogue that almost no one reaches for, and that I think is closer than most. Walk it.
When Direct Broadcast Satellite, DBS, emerged commercially in the early 1990s, the dominant question in the trade press was a version of, why would anyone want this when we already have cable television? Cable was already in tens of millions of American homes. It had been built out over decades. It was reliable, it was familiar, it was cheaper than the 18-inch DirecTV dish on your roof. The pitch for satellite was, you can get it everywhere, including rural areas cable doesn't reach, and you can get more channels. And there was a wave of skepticism that lasted years. Satellite is a niche solution, people said. It's for places cable doesn't go. It will never have the market share.
And then, 10 years later, DirecTV and Dish between them have something like 30 million subscribers, are competing head-on with cable for the mass market, and are taken seriously enough that the cable company's strategy documents treat them as the primary competitive threat. The niche became the mainstream alternative.
And then television itself moved to internet streaming and made both of them obsolete 20 years after that. But that's a different episode.
That's a different episode, and worth noting because it tells you something about technology arcs. The dominant solution at any moment can be eaten by the niche solution, can be eaten by the next niche solution. But the relevant pattern for our purposes is the first transition, skepticism. Why would you ever do this when the terrestrial version works fine? Followed by, small niche use cases prove the concept. Followed by, the niche grows faster than the skeptics predicted. Followed by, the niche becomes a real alternative for the mainstream. Followed by, both options coexist, serving different parts of the market with different cost and performance profiles.
That's the arc orbital data centers are most likely to follow. They will not replace AWS US East. They will not even compete with AWS US East for most workloads. They will serve specific workloads. AI training, sovereign storage, Earth observation edge processing, defense, where the orbital economics are genuinely better. They will be a niche that grows. And 10 years from now, the question will not be, are space data centers a thing? The question will be, for what fraction of the market are they the right answer? And is that fraction growing or stable?
That's the realistic version.
That's the realistic version, not the cloud goes to space. More like,
An additional specialised tier in the cloud is now in space, and it does specific things very well.
So the answer to, could we host data centres in space, is, we just did. The answer to should we depends on what kind of data, in what orbit, for what customer, in what year, at what launch cost.
That's the answer. And the answer to, is this real, is, it stopped being a thought experiment in late 2025, when an LLM was trained on a GPU in orbit by a two-year-old company backed by the dominant AI chip vendor, while Google announced their own program in the same news cycle. The frame has shifted. The interesting question is no longer, will this happen? The interesting question is, what does it look like when it does?
A couple of things I want to come back to in future episodes. Gerard O'Neill, The 76 book, that's its own movie. The history of cooling in extreme environments, submarines, deep sea, polar bases and now space, that's its own episode. The radiation hardening story. The field that said no for 40 years and then said maybe.
Put them on the list.
They're on the list. The bigger picture today, the answer to, could we put data centres in space, is yes. The question is no longer whether, the question is what shape and for whom. We will know a lot more by 2028 than we do today.
Thanks for listening. I'm Freya.
I'm Pip. This was Analyst.